let me in. Shiba shiba, I wanna be closer to you. Shiba shiba, open up your soul. Shiba shiba, let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your love.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Or for today, how about understand something? Science does not take a holiday, and that's good because we need science. We need the principles of science to work at all times. So I have a science envoy here today from Wonderfest to talk about a branch of science that I know you're going to be interested in. So I'd like to welcome Sophia Lee. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the show today, especially on this beautiful day when you could be out frolicking in nature. So before we get into the science of it, tell me, when did you realize that you enjoyed science?
Oh, well, so I would say I really discovered my current field, which is like business psychology, during my junior year of college, when I was like looking for things to do over the summer, and I found this really cool summer research program that was happening at the business school. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, like I didn't know that you could study just like day-to-day social life for a living. So I think that's when I kind of like discovered my field and got really excited about that. But I guess I've been pretty interested in like science and STEM more broadly for like most of my life.
Okay, so when you were in college, were you majoring in business and then you segued into the psychology end of it, or explain that?
Oh, yeah, not at all. Okay, so I guess I should preface by saying, so my field is this really obscure field called organizational behavior.
Uh-huh.
It's also called management at some business schools,
okay.
But it's really like the discipline is based in psychology. So when I was an undergrad, I was actually studying applied math, which is something I've just sort of been into for most of my life. And then I was actually doing applied math with a focus in psychology. So I was just kind of like, you know, taking some psych classes for fun, basically. And then I discovered like business school psychology or, you know, organizational behavior or management. And then I was like, oh, like, okay, this is it. Like, I like psychology, but it didn't really like feel quite right.
Uh-huh.
Or it wasn't like exactly like so exciting that I was like, this is something I want to dedicate my life to. But I think just like looking at the kinds of things people were studying in business psychology was just like really like intrinsically interesting. I was like, oh, this is like the kind of thing I think about all the time. It's like, you know, daily social life, conversations, judgment, decision making. So yeah.
Okay, so so business psychology is that a fairly new discipline, or has it been around for a while?
Well, I guess it depends on what you think of as fairly new. So compared to something like physics, which is, you know, thousands of years, well,
sure.
Yeah, let's say thousands of years old, right?
Okay.
It's very new. So psychology itself is only about maybe like a little bit more than 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm not entirely sure when business schools started having like specific management departments, but I think some of my professors were getting their degrees in like the 80s, so at least that old. But
okay.
Yeah, it is fairly fairly new.
Okay, so talk about what was it about the like business psychology, because you said you think about these, you were thinking about these things already, and then this discipline appeared in front of you. So what was it about it? What are the things that you think about that made this a good fit for you?
Well, I think it's some things that like just everybody thinks about. So when I was in undergrad and I was like looking at these summer research programs, there's a professor, her name is Allison Wood Brooks. And she does a lot of research on, like, conversations. And I remember just, like, seeing, like, one paper. And, like, the paper was literally just, like question asking increases liking. So people like talking about themselves. So if you ask them to talk about themselves, then they'll actually like you more because they're like, oh, they're interested in me.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, like, one, like, little finding. And I was like, oh, like, that's really cool. Like, that's something that's super applicable to everyday life, and it's just interesting to think about, and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another paper by Erica Boothby and some of her co-authors, and it was called The Liking Gap, and like the finding there, and she has a couple like follow-up papers on this, but the finding there is that when people meet each other, or even in like, you know, more established relationships, mm-hmm. people tend to underestimate how much other people like them. And I don't know, I just think these findings are like really cool. They're really easy to talk about with like lay people,
mm-hmm.
And really just like kind of fun and interesting, and just like things that you could realistically apply and think about in your everyday life.
Okay, so then let's get deeper into that. So when you talk about business psychology, what is it used for, and what are some of the things that you've learned about business psychology that that maybe seem counterintuitive?
Ooh, okay, that's fun. Okay, well, so the second question is like a huge like thing we can get into, like heuristics and biases and all that in a second.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of what it's used for, so I guess there's like, so like the most applied version of business psychology or organizational behavior or management is like thinking about like in a company, things like what kind of leadership styles work best, what kinds of teams are most effective, you know, whether like more diverse teams, for example, are going to be more effective than less diverse. Like they should be like really applied things that are useful in the workplace.
Okay.
So like leadership, teamwork, culture, all those kinds of concepts, those are like the most applied. And then kind of on the other end of the management kind of field is these like more kind of abstract, like social psychology almost findings. So like the kinds of things I just talked to you about. So I go to Berkeley, mm-hmm. and our department tends to be more like social psych
mm-hmm.
heavy. So our findings would be more like the kind of conversation stuff that I mentioned before. But then on the other hand, some schools like Kellogg or NYU, maybe those departments would focus more on like the kind of like super applied management side of things.
Okay.
Let me know if you want to follow up on that. Otherwise, we can get to the like counterintuitive heuristics and biases type things.
I want to put a pin in that and go, the second thing. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll come back to
have you ever read the book Thinking Fast and Slow?
Never. Go.
Okay. So it's this book about 15 years old now,
mm-hmm.
and it's by this guy named Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winning econ/psychologist, actually just passed away earlier this year,
mm-hmm.
but he wrote this really great book. I highly recommend it to all of your viewers, again, called Thinking Fast and Slow. And he, along with Amos Tversky in like the 70s or 80s, they documented just like a ton of really kind of irrational or counterintuitive things that humans like to do.
Okay.
So maybe I don't know how well I can give an example. But okay, so there's one thing called like the conjunction fallacy. So let me just, like, let's say you hear about this is called the Linda problem. It's very famous. You can Google it. But it's you learn about this woman named Linda. You learn that she's like very into like social justice. She like volunteers her time to do all these things, blah blah blah. She was involved in all these like student groups when she was in college.
Mm-hmm.
And then you read a bunch of statements that are possibly about Linda, like Linda is a bank teller, Linda is a librarian, Linda is a feminist. And then there's one that's like Linda is a feminist and a bank teller.
Mm-hmm.
And then people rate that statement as more likely than just Linda is a bank teller, because even though it's impossible for something that's like X and Y to be more probable than just X,
mm-hmm.
people are like thinking that because I think she's a feminist, like this description kind of matches her more, even though it's like probabilistically less likely.
Okay. I think I understand. You're saying that in all of the choices, you know, one of them would be, but the more things you include in a description, the less likely it is that all of the things in that description are true, but people think mm-hmm. it's true.
Yeah, exactly. If they think that like one of the things in the description is kind of more representative mm-hmm. of the initial description, even though mathematically it's not going to be true. Yeah, sorry, that was kind of a complicated example to explain, but yeah.
Okay, so in thinking fast and slow, like, why is it called thinking fast, and are there fast thoughts and slow thoughts?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Okay, so thinking fast and slow, so he talks about, like, a system one brain and a system two brain, which, like, they're not, like, extremely, like, separate in the actual mind, but that's, like, kind of how it comes out in your behavior and decision making. So I think the system one brain is the one that is, like, basically the fast one, and it is, like, more subject to kinds of these, like, irrational pitfalls, let's call them.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of just, like, goes through and, like, thinks more automatically. And then the system two brain, the slow one, is more trying to, like, is the one that's, like, more slow and is like, wait a second, that doesn't actually make sense. And, like, kind of thinks things through more slowly. So I think the idea is that, like, automatically our default behavior is to kind of, like, think fast, think mm-hmm. automatically. Mm-hmm. It's more efficient that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, evolutionarily, it makes more sense to just, like, you know, think quickly and
quickly evaluate
and
something.
Learn over time. But yeah.
Okay. So in a business setting, so you're studying business psychology. So what mm-hmm. kinds of counterintuitive things happen in business psychology that's hard to dispel?
Well, I think something that's really interesting is that, you know, people talk about Danny Kahneman. He is this, like, great famous psychologist who wrote, like, tons of papers, tons of books about all these biases. So I just mentioned one, which was, like, conjunction or representativeness. There's tons of other biases, confirmation bias, framing bias. And, like, even he was really, like, sometimes subject to these biases. So I mm-hmm. think, like, that kind of just goes to show that, like, these kinds of biases are really hard to dispel no matter how much you learn about them. So
sure.
We teach our MBA students about these biases in their very first class of their like leadership class. And still, like, I don't expect that they're going to completely go away when they go on to become managers and they're, you know, trying to make decisions for their teams and organizations. Like, I'm sure some of them will still fall victim to confirmation bias like all of us do.
All right. Well, then let me shift gears and talk about, business culture. So mm-hmm. when you're looking at business cultures and you're comparing the relative output of each kind of culture, are there certain cultures that think they're doing better, but they're actually doing worse against all the other cultures?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Well, I think, okay, I'm not totally sure, but I kind of would imagine that if you're a leader in an organization and mm-hmm. you thought you had a bad culture, mm-hmm. then presumably you would change it, right? So
right.
I assume that most people, well, maybe not, but but I assume, like, let's assume that's true. In that case, if you observe any variance in cultures and some are performing better than others, and objectively, there must be some people who are overconfident about how well their culture performs.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of, like, which cultures are actually better, well, to be honest, it's not really my my area, but there's
okay.
a couple of dimensions of cultures I can describe.
Please.
That are, like, pretty well studied.
Okay.
So, the most classic one is kind of this individualistic versus collectivistic dimension. And this is, like, not just in organizations, but also, like, it's actually usually studied on, like, a country or kind of scale.
Mm-hmm.
So individualistic cultures, people are mostly, they think of themselves as, like, individual people, very, like, autonomous. And in collectivistic cultures, people think of themselves more as, like, in relation to other people or as part of their family or part of their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So the really, like, classic ways you could demonstrate this are, like, people in individualistic cultures. If you show them like a picture of an ocean, this is, like, a really classic experiment that I am forgetting the citation for, but it's like you show them a picture of an ocean with mm-hmm. a fish in the front or something.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, please describe this. the people in the individualistic cultures will be like, oh, it's a fish. And then the people in the collectivistic cultures will be like, oh, it's like a ocean or it's like a ecosystem or something like that. So I guess that sounds pretty far away from the business setting, but there would be cultures that are company cultures where people are kind of more just like, you know, working on their own versus like they're thinking more about how does my work fit into the team or something, for example. So that's one dimension that gets a lot of attention in the literature. There's another dimension that I think Michelle Gelfand is most famous for. Mm-hmm. It's tight versus loose cultures. And I think the best culture is probably somewhere in the middle, but the idea is that like tight cultures are one where it's pretty homogenous and you're kind of, it's like looked down upon basically to like be or behave differently from other people.
Okay.
And then loose cultures are basically one where like your like behaviors are a lot more loose at the group level. So like people just behave however they want and it's like good to do that and stuff. But I think, you know, you want some cohesion and then you also want some like room for thought diversity and such. So
Okay. Tech
answer is probably somewhere in the middle.
Okay. Now we hear a lot about, and you know, a lot of people actually experience it firsthand. We talk about a toxic business culture. Are there certain features that all toxic cultures have in common, or are there certain features that all successful business cultures have in common?
That is a very difficult question. So in terms of toxic cultures, I don't know if there's something we can say that they all have in common other mm-hmm. than like from the outcome perspective, which would be mm-hmm. like they have employees who are unhappy and burnt out or mm-hmm. something like that. One antecedent to more negative culture is you can think about like the leader's behavior. So there's kind of a recent paper by Jenny Chapman and some colleagues that talk about narcissistic leaders mm-hmm. and how organizations that have more narcissistic leaders kind of have this trickle-down effect where that means they end up leading organizations that are less emphasizing collaboration and integrity, and they might be emphasizing more like negative attributes. So like people might be more likely to like cut corners or like cheat if you're doing a you know lab experiment or something. But at the organizational level, you might see that narcissistic leaders, their traits kind of bleed into some negative outcome for the overall organizational culture, even though they're just one person.
Okay. Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's Touching Your Mind right now? Sophia Lee is our PhD student from Wonderfest, talking about how people understand their own and others' minds and judgments. Can you talk a little bit more about your particular focus? Because you say that you're particularly interested in studying how people think about conversations and communication.
Yeah, okay. So I would say I have two kinds of major areas of interest. So one is about communication and conversation. And I guess there's two major projects that I could talk about. One is about ghosting, like in kind of when you're texting other people, like what do people think about when they get ghosted by the other person? Mm-hmm. And then the other project I'm working on in that domain is how people assign blame for miscommunication. And then the other kind of research that I do is about confidence and overconfidence.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple things there. One is, so I guess overconfidence is like, I guess one of the kinds of biases that people are often vulnerable to, which is that they're generally more confident than they should be about how skills or how likely they are to be right, for example.
Is there a gender breakdown in terms of overconfidence?
Wow, what a great question, and one that is hotly debated in the literature. there's some claims in the literature that men are more overconfident than women. There's also a lot of null findings on that. I'll say in my own data, mm-hmm. I've found that men are more confident than women, mm-hmm. but not more overconfident.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's actually a pretty interesting question. That's probably So I was going to say, so one of the projects on overconfidence I have is whether this is a question of whether some people are more overconfident than others. Mm-hmm. And so one of the first questions we always get is like the most famous claim about individual differences and overconfidence mm-hmm. is about like gender differences and overconfidence. So that's a great question.
Oh, thank you.
I'll just say the evidence is still coming in on that one.
Okay.
You'll have to stay tuned.
Because I always read these things that say like for example, when people are applying for a job, if a guy is qualified for like 50% of what they ask for, they're like, oh yeah, I'm in. And a woman will feel like she has to, you know, be qualified for everything on the list before she's willing to apply to that job.
Yeah, there's a lot of research on, so a lot of research that's specifically about gender is about those kinds of like, I don't know what you would call them, but like, I don't, let's just call them like promotion points or something. That's mm-hmm. not an actual term. But at that point of applying to jobs, you might think that like women are less likely to advocate for themselves. And then there's a lot of research on like negotiations and gender where people think that like women are going to be less likely to stand up for themselves in negotiations, or they're going to be worse at negotiations, that kind of thing. So I don't think there's actually data showing that women are worse at negotiations, mm-hmm. But like, yeah, maybe that they're less likely to advocate for themselves at these kind of like critical points.
Okay. So yeah. I want to double back to how people understand their own and others' minds and judgments. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So mind perception is a really kind of not old, but well, okay, it's a relatively older line of research that I'm kind of building on. Mm-hmm. So like one kind of very classic idea is just that like people are kind of egocentric mm-hmm. when they think about others' minds. So if I want to try to understand what someone else is thinking, mm-hmm. basically what happens is I'll like project what I myself am thinking onto them. Mm-hmm. And then I'll like adjust towards whatever I think about them to be like, okay, well now this is what I think their belief is based on my own belief about myself. And usually people find that, we adjust insufficiently mm-hmm. when we're thinking about what other people think. So like if you, I guess I should probably give an example, but I guess if I was trying to guess how much you like ice cream or something, mm-hmm. well, I don't know that much about how I would guess that. But then I would probably think, well, how much do I like ice cream, right? And then I would try to do some adjustment like, okay, maybe you like ice cream a little bit more or a little bit less than me. I'd adjust a little bit from my own estimate. And what would probably happen is I would get a little bit closer to what you actually think, but I wouldn't adjust enough so that my final estimate would still be closer to my own beliefs about myself than they should be, basically. So that's the idea of egocentric bias. Mm-hmm. And a lot of like research is trying to like work on these really, really small ideas, but then they all become part of this bigger picture. So egocentric bias is kind of this bigger picture that basically anyone who's doing any research on conversation or communication or social psychology more broadly, you probably are going to be thinking about how egocentric bias plays a part in your results. So for example, mm-hmm. I mentioned I'm doing a project on ghosting, and one of the things we're trying to look at there is how accurately people understand how the other person feels. So mm-hmm. does a ghoster understand how the ghostee feels, and does the ghostee understand how the ghoster feels? And kind of on both sides, we find that, and we ask people like, how happy do you feel or something? And then how happy do you think the other person feels? You get a lot of questions like this. Mm-hmm. And like in a lot of cases, you see people answering very similarly on both of those questions.
Okay. So I have a couple of questions. All right. So first of all, with egocentric bias, if people know that there's egocentric biases, are there any types of tricks or ways to counter that egocentric bias in yourself, number one? And then number two, how do the ghosters and ghosties feel about it, and how do they think the others feel about it?
Yeah. So I'll do the egocentric bias question first.
Okay.
So So first I'll just say that egocentric bias kind of like makes some sense, because in cases where you really don't know a lot about the other person or the other person's judgments, mm-hmm. like the easiest thing to do is to think about how you feel, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of research on like perspective taking, and that's also supposed to be like on the applied side of things. Perspective taking is something that they teach a lot in like the negotiations context, where like you want to think about, like, put yourself in the other person's shoes, that kind of thing, where mm-hmm. you're like, okay, like, what does the other person want from this situation? I'm talking about negotiations now, but it's like, what is their goal from this situation? Like, are there things that I value more than them? And those are cases where then you could, like, maybe more easily come to an agreement if it's not, like, a completely zero-sum setting. So okay. for egocentric bias, basically just some kind of perspective taking is, like, the easiest way to go about it, or if you have a lot of time and it's really important for you to understand how the other person thinks, of course you could like ask other people and kind of solicit several judgments and try to aggregate them all together somehow.
Okay
yeah. And then oh sorry,
no go on.
Yeah, well I was just gonna move on to the ghosting stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, one interesting thing we found, which we totally weren't expecting to find, by the way. So when we started this project, we thought we were going to get something like, oh, the ghosties feel really bad because they were ghosted, and they shouldn't feel that bad because in reality, the ghosters probably just like forgot to ghost them or something. But we ended up not actually really finding a ton of evidence for that. And like what we're more consistently finding is that the ghosters actually feel a little bit worse about ghosting than mm-hmm. the ghosties think. So like the ghosties think, oh, like maybe they just forgot or, you know, whatever, got busy.
Mm-hmm.
But the ghosters are actually like, even if they did forget or like get busy, they're actually like, oh my gosh, I actually feel bad. Like I totally left this person hanging, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, we were like, weren't really expecting to find that, but that's kind of what we're getting when we ask people to think about times when they've ghosted others, or we kind of ask them to like read about cases, like imagine that you ghosted this person or imagine that you were ghosted. And like when they're literally given the same information, people who are like imagining that they ghost someone else are like, wow, actually I feel really bad. And the ghosties are like, oh, they probably don't care that much. So that's kind of an interesting little gap that we've found.
So is there a difference between people who accidentally ghost people versus people who deliberately ghost people?
Well, I wouldn't want to say anything about the like permanent traits of people, but those are definitely very different types of ghosting. So
mm-hmm.
I mean sometimes like we just ask people like to, you know, think about a time when they ghosted someone else. And we get, like, extremely different results. Like, there are some people who are like, oh, yeah, like, I guess I didn't respond to my friend when she asked me something. Like, oops, I feel bad about that. But then there's people who are like, yeah, there was this really toxic person who I did not like, and I absolutely wanted to cut ties with them. So I don't feel bad about that at all because I totally meant to do it. So there's, like,
got it.
A huge difference in the kinds of situations where people ghost. But I don't know. I think that I'd be more inclined to say that whether people ghost or not, or why people ghost, is more dependent on like just the situation or the relationship that they're in, rather than some like permanent trait that makes them different.
Got it. Now, you've been studying business psychology for a while. What was something that you learned in your studies that really sort of blew your mind?
I don't know. I feel like there's something interesting. There's an interesting book by Duncan Watts called Everything is Obvious Once You Know the Answer.
True.
And I kind of feel like that's how it is, where it's like, I'm sure at the time when I learned stuff, I was like, whoa, this is crazy. But now I just look back and I'm like, yeah, you know, all kind of makes sense.
Oh, yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Well, then,
which is kind of funny.
Then what is something that you tell people that they have that reaction? Like, well, now that you say it, that mm-hmm. does make sense.
Yeah. I guess we can go back to heuristics and biases. I'll try to give an example that's not so convoluted, like the Linda.
Now, what are heuristics?
Oh, heuristics are like mental shortcuts.
Oh, okay.
So this is kind of more of the system one fast thinking, where you are trying to think about something, but then, you know, you just like take some little shortcut rather than like writing all the possible reasons down. And it makes sense. You just save time. Okay. Mm-hmm. So here's something. It's also works a lot in these applied settings like negotiations. Okay. So there's this idea of anchoring. And it's like basically like when you get some initial, let's say it's a number, when you get some initial number, that influences your later judgments a lot more than it should, even if the anchor is totally arbitrary. So, like, here's the first example of anchoring I ever saw. Mm-hmm. It's like, write down the last four digits of your phone number or something. So just four totally random numbers. Mm-hmm. So you write those down. And then the next question is like, what is the length of the Nile River? And then you write down whatever your guess is. That most people don't know the actual answer. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you write down some guess of the Nile River. And then, so we did this question as a class, and then you show the distance between like people's like whatever last four digits of their phone number and then their guess for the Nile River length, and like the numbers are like much closer than like makes sense to be. So basically, like, people are kind of anchoring even on this very obviously completely arbitrary number when they're making estimates afterwards.
That's interesting. And what does that knowledge afford you?
Well, I guess basically just to not be, well, so, okay, so that case is a very arbitrary anchor, but a lot of the times anchors can be used against you. So if you're buying and selling stuff, people will often like use this anchoring thing to their advantage, and they'll be like, well, you know, they set some like arbitrarily high price or something. And then even if you obviously know that that's a completely ridiculous number that you should never even consider, like, you're still kind of anchored to that initial number. So a lot of the times, like in negotiations, there's like people saying, oh, like, you should always be the one making the first offer or something like that, because you're trying to set that anchor. But if you're aware of this now, now hopefully you won't be, you know, arbitrarily anchored to some number that you shouldn't be anchored to. So that's actually something that's kind of applicable, whether it's buying and selling or, you know, just like thinking about things. You're like, well, should I really be anchored on this random thing that probably is not at all related to what I'm interested in?
So do people who enjoy haggling, do they have a leg up in that sphere because they know that first number is completely ridiculous and they go for like a completely ridiculous low price?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think it's a, it's like, that's like probably the most direct application of anchoring. It's, yeah, just like, well, okay. So I guess I shouldn't make so many blanket statements. So one thing is like, if you make a completely ridiculous offer, then people will just like reject it and just like not trust you anymore and like completely walk away. So don't do that. But if you set something that's like, you know, really favorable to you, but like still kind of in the range of reasonableness, then yeah, that's definitely advantageous.
Okay. So we just have like a few minutes left. So you mentioned the book Thinking Fast and Slow. Are there other books that you think our listeners would benefit in reading to get more of an understanding of your field?
Yeah, there's a great book by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein. It's called Nudge. It's from 2008. They might have written like an updated version of this. I'm actually not sure, but it's called Nudge, and it's like pretty similar in terms of thinking about like behavioral sciences and decision making. And they talk about some interesting applications for like retirement savings and getting people to do that. So I think that's another great book. I would definitely start with Thinking Fast and Slow. That's like, that was actually assigned as like required reading in some classes, but it's like written for lay people, so it's not at all technical. And Danny Kahneman is like a really, really good writer. so Thinking Fast and Slow, Nudge. I think Dan Gilbert also has a book called Stumbling on Happiness, not to be confused with Dan Gilbert of the Cleveland Cavaliers. But yeah, Stumbling on Happiness. Jan Gilbert's also just a fantastic writer, and it's an enjoyable read. And then also another Richard Thaler book, which is, it's like less, maybe less interesting as a topic. It's called Misbehaving. It's about like the founding of behavioral economics. So basically, like, he's talking about, like, in the 1970s, when this field of kind of behavioral science and applied behavioral science is like getting off the ground. So I don't know if it's that interesting to people outside of the field, but I feel like the writing is sufficiently fun and interesting that I think it would still be fun, even if they're not actually in the field. So I'd say those four books are pretty fun.
Excellent. And if people want to find out more about your specific branch of research, where would they go online to read, to learn more about it?
Wow, that is a great question. I absolutely need to make a website for myself. It does not exist. It will soon. Maybe stay tuned on that for now. I mean, just keep the Sophia Lee from UC Berkeley kind of idea in the back of your minds. And hopefully one day when you Google that, something will come up.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Sophia Lee, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today and introducing our listening audience to a branch of psychology that we didn't even know about.
All right. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you again for having me.
And I hope you have a lovely, lovely day today.
Thank you. You too.
All right. People of Earth, science. There's so much out there. There's so many branches that we don't even know about that are amazing and cool. And you know, human behavior is just, it's worthy of being explored.
ancient world, there were seven wonders. We'll start with my favorite. It's really humongous, and it's still here today. Unlike the others, its design might be why it survived the longest. Yep, I'm talking about the pyramids. 2600 BC is when they were built. Take a trip really quick, travel a little bit. You'll see them in the city of Giza in Egypt. Well, I guess that we're on to the next one. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon. The history's a mystery. The day it was built seems to be unknown by anyone. They say that way back in Iraq is the place that they built the Hanging Garden. It is also said that this paradise was planted in an artificial mountain. Amazing, these wonders will blow your mind. You might wanna hold on tight. This could be a wild ride, ride, ride.
Look around, cause they're everywhere. Doesn't it blow your mind? All these wonders, they're all around. Gotta stop and stare at all these wonders everywhere.
Century BC, a temple was built over in Turkey. The temple of Artemis at Ephesus was built for the Greek goddess Artemis. I guess I better not miss what happened a century before this. Another statue was built which was enormous. Your jaw would drop to your knees if you saw the 40-foot statue of Zeus in Greece. This one was built for King Marcellus, the mausoleum at Halicarnassus. Built in the 4th century BC in the country of Turkey, its size is monstrous.
Amazing, these wonders will blow your mind. You might wanna hold on tight. This could be a wild ride, ride, ride. Look around, cause they're everywhere. Doesn't it blow your mind? All these wonders, they're all around. Gotta stop and stare at all these wonders everywhere.
In the Mediterranean Sea, built in the 4th century BC, is a wonder called the Colossus of Rhodes, built for the Greek sun god Helios. 110 foot, this one's for the record books. I wonder how long it took to build, now my mind's hooked. The view of a statue that huge would have you shocked. How cool would that look? The world's first lighthouse, used mirrors to reflect the sunlight for miles out. You can see it far away at sea, built in the 3rd century BC. The Lighthouse of Alexandria, sounds amazing, man, I'm telling ya. Too bad we can no longer see it, it was in Egypt, in Africa.
Amazing, these wonders will blow your mind. You might wanna hold on tight. This could be a wild ride, ride, ride. Amazing, these wonders will blow your mind. You might wanna hold on tight. This could be a wild ride, ride, ride. Look around, cause they're everywhere. Doesn't it blow your mind? All these wonders.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That's Renaud Francoeur and the Seven Wonderful Wonders from Brain Beats 2. And we also got to hear Bjork in Human Behavior from Debut. Speaking of debut, there is a show coming down the pike called Johnny and June Forever, and that's happening at Rancho Nicasio. Here to talk about the show and maybe grace us with a number or two are Johnny and June themselves. I'd like to welcome Essence Goldman and Danny Evans. Hello.
Hello.
Well, hi there.
How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. We're so happy to be here today.
So first of all, tell me a little bit about Johnny and June Forever. Are you guys hardcore Johnny Cash fans or June Cash?
June, June Carter Cash?
You might say so, yeah. My father, Rusty Evans, was led a Johnny Cash tribute band for 20-some-odd years.
Oh, wow.
I was the band director for, and I played lead guitar, and he passed away almost 10 years ago now, and when she and I met, I was completely done with the Johnny Cash thing, and people kept comparing us to Johnny and June, and it just seemed like a natural thing for us to do.
Okay, and you did you come to him fully formed as a June?
Absolutely not. I actually never really sang any covers in my life, hardly at all, before Danny and I met. But I was mainly doing original music. But Danny and I, we met in the studio recording my forthcoming record, and we just realized that we loved singing. It was very, natural, the harmonies, and we started playing a lot of shows together. People started comparing us to Johnny and June, just like, you know, we were having a good time.
Oh,
and,
that's cool.
So people could feel that. And then we thought, well, why not just throw in a Johnny and June song now and again? And then we did, and it was, you know, a lot of fun, and people wanted a whole show. So that's how it happened.
Very cool. So how long have you been doing the Johnny and June Forever show?
Since before the pandemic.
Okay.
We'd gone and done some convention shows in New York.
York
and this and that, and we were got set up with a whole national booking agency and all this and that, and then the pandemic hit, and we were back underground for another 2 years. We're emerging now again.
Well, that's great. So you guys are here, and my listening audience, I know you can hear the little guitars in the background. So I want to make sure that they hear some songs. So what will you grace us with right now?
I think we should probably do something obvious like Jackson.
Oh, well, I brought my fan.
Okay.
Not that you're going to see it out there.
Oh,
but yes. Yeah, we're going to play Jackson.
Excellent.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Gonna mess around.
I'll bet you will.
Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
Well, you go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell. You go play your hand. You be talking, man. Make a big fool of yourself. Oh, you go to Jackson. Why don't you comb your hair?
Well, I would, but I think I'm on a snowball, Jackson.
Oh, I bet you will. See if I care.
Well, when I breeze into that city, them people gonna stoop and bow.
Ha!
And all them women gonna make me teach them what they don't know how. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. So turn loose my coat. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson.
Goodbye, that's all she wrote. Well, I laugh at you in Jackson, and I'll be dancing on the pony cave. Oh, I'll lead you around town like a scalded hound with your tail tucked between your legs. Oh, you go to Jackson. You big talking man.
I'm your big talking man.
I'll be waiting in Jackson behind my J-Pan fan.
Well, we got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson.
And that's
turn
a
the
fact.
Oh, yeah, we going to Jackson. They never coming back.
Yay! Excellent. I love that. You guys are amazing. So how long have you been doing this together?
Oh, this is just before the pandemic.
So
five or so years.
Okay, so you do like a year, the pandemic shuts everybody down.
Yeah.
So are you doing it via Zoom, or how are you guys, you know, blending your harmonies so well?
Well, we do live together and all.
Oh, okay.
You know. Yeah. We spend time together.
We're a bit more like Johnny and June in more than one way.
All right.
A lot of parallels.
So tell me about this show, Johnny and June Forever. Is it like a review of songs, or is it like a play?
Well, it's not a play.
Okay.
But it's sort of, you know, you kind of go through time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of visual references to the passage of time and telling their story.
There are some costume changes.
Oh, just a few. We have a lot of fun with costume changes.
Okay.
And the costumes reflect the time period that the songs were sung.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell the story of the unfolding of the relationship between Johnny and June. And, you know, and, the, and it spanned quite a few years they were together.
Okay. So you basically went into the family business of doing the
I had
Johnny.
No intention of doing so if it weren't for her.
And I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't for him.
Yeah.
I never was looking to do anything like this, but it is fun. And it, you know, we get to spend time together and do the thing, you know, that it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We make original music, too, and we throw in a couple of originals
at
the end as well. But, you know, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, people love Johnny Cash and they love June Carter Cash. And it's a way for us to pay tribute to, you know, our inspirations for our original music also. You know, the king of country music and the Carter family. It's a journey into the great American songbook.
Well, so tell for our listening audience who's got they've gotten a taste now and they're like, "Yep, I'm in." So you guys are going to be at Rancho Nicasio. Now, what's Rancho Nicasio?
It's in the town of Nicasio, which is out in West Marin, kind of out in the boonies. It's a roadhouse. I would call it dinner theater or a dinner and a show.
Dinner and a show.
Uh-huh.
It's a great. They have fantastic food. They're just about maybe 10-15 minutes away from Fairfax, not far outside of San Rafael.
Oh, okay.
So just in Marin County. And, it's a great venue. It's a beautiful place to just go and have an evening out. And if you can spend a couple hours in the area, it's a beautiful place to go hiking out there. And there's lakes and forests. It's one of our favorite places.
Very cool. And that's this Saturday?
Saturday the 7th, yeah.
One night only, Saturday, September 7th, dinner and a show at Rancho Nicasio.
It's a very rural place. They have a baseball field in the middle of the town, a post office, and the Rancho Nicasio, and maybe a Druids Hall, and that's about it.
It's a destination, and they have a lot of great music. They have all kinds of great bands go out there all the time. You know, you can go on their website to see the caliber of music that they bring in there.
And what's their website?
Their website is Rancho Nicasio, which is NICASIO.com.
Okay.
There's a lot of great artists that are playing there all the time.
And if people want to find out more about what you guys are doing, how do they go about doing that?
Well, you can go to JohnnyAndJuneForever.com.
Oh, that's easy. Okay.
And you can also find our original music at EssenceAndGoldCountry.com.
Excellent.
And, we're on the Facebook and all that other stuff.
And Instagram.
With Johnny and June Forever on Facebook and
Instagram.
All that.
All right.
All the places.
Well, I want to thank you both for being here, and I'm hoping you'll give us one more song.
All right.
Sounds good.
Well, what would you like to do? I had planned on doing something, but it doesn't. You don't really sing on that one, so.
Harmonies on Rose, or
we could
do Carpenter. What do you want?
Let's do If I Were a Carpenter. That's
okay.
A good one.
Okay. And until next week, my friends, we're gonna end the show with Johnny and June Forever. Until next week, my friends, ta ta and toodly do.
Thank you so much for having us. By the way,
you're
this
welcome.
Is really fun.
You're welcome.
I cannot find this here.
Do you want to talk about?
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
If you were a carpenter and I were a lady, I'd marry you anyway. anyway, I'd have your baby.
If a tinker was my tree, would I still find you?
I'd be carrying the pots you made, following behind you.
Save your love through loneliness, save your love through sorrow. I give you my loneliness, give me your tomorrow. If I were a miller at a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your colored blouse and your soft shoes shining?
Well, if you were a miller at the mill wheel grinding, I'd not miss my colored blouse or my soft shoes shining.
Save your love through loneliness, save your love through sorrow. I gave you my loneliness, give me your tomorrow. If I worked my hands in wood, would you still love me?
Well, I'd answer you, yes, I would.
And would you not be above me?
I would not be above you.
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady,
well, I'd marry you anyway. I'd have your baby. I would.
That's good news. Save your love through loneliness, save your love through sorrow. I gave you my loneliness, give me your tomorrow. Give me your tomorrow. Give me your tomorrow. Give me your tomorrow.
Thank you for listening to KPOO San Francisco.